Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome back. We come your way 7 days a week to tell you interesting things about our world. And we do it in a way that makes it easy for you to improve your American English skills. Today, our first stop is a place near New York City that many of America's immigrants knew very well when they first set foot on land in their new home. Then we're off to South Africa to hear about a man who makes his living in an unusual way. If you like the outdoors, and particularly fishing, you are sure to like this one. So if you are ready, let's listen and learn with the Voice of America. The Ellis Island Immigration Center, close to the lower end of New York City, was a busy place from 1892 to 1954. It processed large numbers of immigrants during those years. Most of the new arrivals came from Europe. But many people moved to North America before the U.S. government opened the center on Ellis Island and after it was closed. A new museum exhibition on the island tells about these immigrants. The exhibit cost $20 million to make. It is called The Peopling of America. Christopher Jones Cruz tells us more about it.
Stephen Brigunti leads the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island Foundation. He says Ellis Island is expanding the way it tells about immigration.
A lot of people were coming here and saying, look, there's nothing here for me. My story isn't told here. Either I came early or, more likely, I've come recently, and you don't say anything about me. So, one, we wanted to remain relevant, and two, we believed it was the right thing to tell the story, the entire story, and this was the right place to do it.
The exhibit shows the earliest days of European exploration in North America. It also tells about colonization and the conflicts with Native Americans, who are often called Indians. While most immigrants were free, many came as slaves. Others were indentured servants. They agreed to move to and work in America in exchange for their freedom. Clay Gish designed the exhibit. She says it was important to say not everyone was free.
We had to deal with slavery. Some people were brought here against their wills. But still, they experienced a journey. They ended up having to adapt to this new land.
A large part of the exhibit shows what happened in the years after 1954, when the Ellis Island Center closed. Immigrants came and continue to come to the U.S. legally and illegally, on airplanes or ships, and on foot. Michael Schneider designed the exhibit's technology and media.
And then we tell the individual story through specific interviews with real immigrants and their experience of making the trips.
And I came to the United States from Nigeria to go to college, and then I went to graduate school at NYU.
The new exhibit explores the changing face of immigration and the changing opinions of Americans on the issue. Rita McGregor visited the new museum. She is from the western city of Santa Fe, New Mexico, just north of the Mexican border.
I find it very interesting that we were so receptive to immigrants a century ago, and now we do not treat them the same.
Mr. Brigunti says immigration is an important part of the American story. He says Americans sometimes make it difficult for immigrants to come to the U.S. But he says we are a nation of immigrants, and we will continue to be. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Now, for something entirely different, we head to South Africa. Marcia James is here to tell us about a man who makes his living with his hands, making beautiful little fishing lures. Marcia?
Alpheus Nglovu has come a long way from his village in the South African province of Mpumalanga. He once worked as a taxi driver. Now he makes fishing flies, artificial man-made flies that are used to catch fish. The flies he now ties are used all over the world by fishers to make record-breaking catches. A man tests a fishing reel in the Fly Fishers Unlimited store in Johannesburg. Next to him is a quiet man in his 40s. Alpheus Nglovu is affectionately known as Alphonse in the flying fishing community. He is seated at a table. Right now, all of his attention seems to be on a fastener that holds a fishing fly. He wants the fly to look like a grasshopper.
Some guys, they send you a picture, just a picture, say, I want this fly. And if you check in a picture, you have to look what the exact material it is, and then you do it.
Alpheus Nglovu uses both natural materials, such as bird feathers, and artificial ones, like plastic and foam. His goal is to make flies look like real creatures. He remembers the first fly he ever tied more than 20 years ago. It was a Clouser minnow. Made of pink and white bucktail, it was used to catch saltwater game fish. Alpheus Nglovu likes to remember the day back in 1994 when he saw the newspaper advertisement that changed his life. The ad was for an apprentice, fly fishing rod builder. At the time, he was still driving a taxi. While making fishing rods, he met the owner of Fly Fishers Unlimited, Murray Petter, who taught him how to tie flies. Mr. Petter says Mr. Nglovu has developed into one of the best fly tiers on the planet.
He's better than me in certain flies without a doubt, because he's just tied hundreds and hundreds of them, you know.
Mr. Petter jokes that Mr. Nglovu is so good that he even has groupies, people who like what he does and who follow him around.
Yeah, a lot of the guys, when they walk in the shop, they just say, how's it, Murray? And they go straight to Alpheus, because they know he's tying the flies. Alphonse is the man, and he's brilliant at it. And he's got a band of loyal clients who regularly come in and say, look, I'm going here, going there. These flies catch fish all over the world, and it's nice to get feedback. It makes us feel great.
Hey, it's you, Dad. This is a bloody brilliant, unbelievable fish.
Oh, my.
Mr. Nglovu says there is nothing better than getting a telephone call from a happy fisherman thanking him for tying a fly that resulted in a dream catch.
I'm known all over the world because of what I'm doing. Tying flies, but I never thought I would be like this. Because I just came here in Joburg to look for a job.
Instead of a job, Alpheus Alphonse Nglovu has found a job that has enabled him to buy a house and to educate his four children. Sitting behind his fastener, he shakes his head and says, life is strange. And then he proceeds to tie another perfect fly. I'm Marcia James.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Have you ever found yourself in this situation? You hear a song you used to sing when you were a child, a bit of nostalgia, but it is not a distant childhood memory. The words come back to you as clearly as when you sang them all those years ago. It seems there is a scientific reason for this. Researchers at the University of Edinburgh studied the relationship between music and remembering a foreign language. They found that remembering words in a song was the best way to remember even one of the most difficult languages. Here is what they did. Researchers took 60 adults and randomly split them into three groups of 20. Then they gave the groups three different types of listen and repeat learning conditions. Researchers had one group simply speak the words. They had the second group speak the words to a rhythm or beat. And they asked the third group to sing the words. All three groups studied words from the Hungarian language for 15 minutes, then took part in a series of language tests to see what they remembered. Why Hungarian, you ask? Researchers said they chose Hungarian because not many people know the language. It does not share any roots with Germanic or Romance languages, such as Italian or Spanish. After the tests were over, the singers came out on top. The people who learned these new Hungarian words by singing them showed a higher overall performance. They did the best in 4 out of 5 of the tests. They also performed 2 times better than those who simply learned the words by speaking them. Dr. Katie O'Vary supervised the study at the university's Reed School of Music. She says singing could lead to new ways to learning a foreign language. The brain, it seems, likes to remember things when they are contained in a catchy or memorable tune. Dr. O'Vary worked with Dr. Karen Ludka and Professor Fernanda Ferreira on this study. Dr. Ludka said the findings could help those who struggle to learn foreign languages. On the University of Edinburgh's website, Dr. Ludka writes, "This study provides the first experimental evidence that a listen and repeat singing method can support foreign language learning. Language teachers already know the value of using music and singing." A teacher at a Chinese language school in Washington, D.C., relies heavily on songs and chants to teach Chinese. Hua Juying teaches students who most likely have never spoken Chinese before coming to the school. Ms. Hua says she uses music all the time to teach children Chinese.
For example, for the little kids, usually we will use English songs, but we are teaching them the Chinese lyrics. So it's easy for them, you know, to start because they already know the music. They just need to translate into, like, Chinese words.
She adds that not only does it work, but it is fun for the kids. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. World War II finally ended in August of 1945. Life in the United States began to return to normal. Soldiers began to come home and find jobs. Factories stopped producing war materials and began to produce goods for peacetime. At the same time, other changes began to take place in society. Many Americans were no longer satisfied with their old ways of life. They wanted something new and better, and many were now earning enough money to find that better life. Millions of Americans moved out of cities and small towns. They bought newly built homes in suburban communities outside busy cities. Today, we look at the growth of suburbs and other changes in the American population in the years after World War II.
And we'll have the living room right in here, and the kitchen right here, so we can see the children playing in the yard.
Yeah, the children. Children? Say, how many are you planning on? Not more than six, I hope. Maybe I better add a few more rooms back here at that.
A married couple in a marketing film for the home building industry. The United States counts its population every 10 years. The first census took place in 1790. At that time, the country had about 4 million people. 100 years later, in 1890, the population was 63 million. By 1950, there were more than 150 million people living in the United States. In the early years of America, the average mother had 8 to 10 children. Living conditions were hard. Many children died at an early age. Families needed a lot of help on the farm, so it was good to have many children. But over the years, birth rates fell. Families began to have fewer and fewer children. By 1900, the average woman had only three or four children. In 1936, during the Great Depression, the average American mother gave birth to only two children. Things changed after World War II. Suddenly, it seemed like every family started having babies. Parents were hopeful about the future. There were lots of jobs. People felt the need for a family and security after the long, difficult years of the war. From 1950 to 1960, the number of children between the ages of 5 and 14 increased by more than 10 million. The increase in births after the war produced what became known as the baby boom generation. An estimated 78 million Americans were born between 1946 and 1964. Many of the new parents moved to homes in the new suburbs built outside the urban environment of cities. Usually, a developer would buy land, maybe from a farmer, then clear it, level it, and build houses on it. Young families would buy the houses with money that they borrowed from local banks. Life was different in the suburbs, calmer, less crowded than life in the big city. There were all sorts of group activities.
There were Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, parent-teacher associations at school, outdoor cooking, where families gathered in someone's backyard to eat hamburgers hot off the grill. Historian William Manchester described life in the suburbs in this way. The new suburbs were free, open, and honestly friendly to anyone except black people, whose time had not yet come. Manchester wrote, families moving in found that their new friends were happy to help get them started. Children in the suburbs exchanged toys and clothing almost as though they were group property. When little Bobby outgrew his clothes, his mother gave them to little Billy across the street. People felt safe enough to leave their doors unlocked. Parents did everything they could to make life good for their children. Between 1950 and 1960, the number of boys playing on Little League baseball teams increased from less than 1 million to almost 6 million. The number of Girl Scouts increased by 2 million. Bicycle sales doubled. And it wasn't just two-wheeled transportation that experienced a boost.
See the USA in your Chevrolet. America's asking you to call. Drive your Chevrolet through the USA. America's the greatest land of all. On a highway or a road along a levee. Performance is sweeter, nothing can beat her. Life is completer in a Chevy. So make a date today to see the USA. See it in your Chevrolet.
U.S. new car production was stopped during World War II to allow those factories to produce airplanes, tanks, and other military vehicles for the war effort. With the prosperity of peacetime, many Americans visited auto dealerships for the first time in years to replace that tired family car with something more up-to-date, even luxurious. For many years, popular singer Dinah Shore invited optimistic post-war Americans to take to the highway and see their country in a Chevrolet.
And see it in your
Post-war prosperity also led Americans to replace outdated home appliances, buy a new refrigerator or a television set.
Come closer, sweetheart. Well, say, I don't think that's fair, because we can't get closer.
Oh, but you could. If you had one of the new Westinghouse television sets with the exclusive electronic magnifier that gives you a big close-up image whenever you want it. All you do is turn the electronic magnifier knob, and there, you get the heart of the picture. And see, I'm close enough to say, hello, good looking.
Actress Betty Furness was commercial spokeswoman for Westinghouse.
And every Sunday night, General Electric brings you the finest motion picture stars on TV. The great names in comedy, in mystery, in romance. Every week a star, all summer long, on the General Electric Theater.
Over at competitor General Electric, actor Ronald Reagan, later the 40th President of the United States and often referred to as the Great Communicator, was for many years an effective television commercial spokesman every week on the GE Theater.
Hey
parents also tried to improve their children's education. In 1960, parents bought almost three times as many educational books as they did 10 years before. Parents also bought millions of dollars worth of pianos, violins, and other musical instruments for their children. It was true that the average number of children per family was increasing, but the total population of the United States did not increase as much during this period as one might have expected. The reason for this was that fewer immigrants were coming to the United States. In fact, the number of immigrants had been dropping for many years. In 1910, 11 immigrants were coming to America for every 1,000 Americans already living here. By 1950, less than 2 immigrants were coming for every 1,000 Americans. Where immigrants were coming from also changed. In the past, most came from Northern and Western Europe. But now, growing numbers of people came to the United States from Southern and Eastern Europe and from Latin America and Asia. Other changes in the United States population were also taking place. In the 1950s, most Americans still lived in the eastern, central, and southern parts of the country. But growing numbers moved west. The population of the western states increased by almost 40% during the 1950s. Remember we said the United States population gets counted every 10 years? One reason is because populations are used to decide how many members each state will have in the House of Representatives. Population changes can mean changes in the political influence of individual states in Congress. Another population change after World War II was in life expectancy. An American born in the early 1900s could only expect to live about 47 years. By the 1950s, however, most Americans could expect to live well past their 60th birthday. Life expectancy continued to increase with improvements in living conditions and medical care. The United States was a changing country, a nation on the move after World War II. Next week on our program, we look at political events that shaped the post-war period. Our program was written by David Jarmel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.